Hello, and thank you for listening to our podcast. My name is Nadine Vanderwijk, and I'm a third-year political science and criminology student at the University of Toronto. In this episode, I'll be talking about Canadian political legal thinker Beverly McLaughlin, who I think is one of the most important political thinkers of our time. This episode has four sections. In the first, I'll talk about who McLaughlin is and discuss some of her background which led to her political positionality. After, I'll discuss some of her novels with a focus on Truth Be Told, her autobiography that details her political legal journey. Then, I'll discuss the many ways McLaughlin has contributed to the modern feminist movement. In the last section, I'll give some of my own thoughts on McLaughlin's work in Truth Be Told and the Canadian legal system more generally. To begin, I'll answer the question of who is Beverly McLaughlin? McLaughlin was originally born in Pincher Creek, Alberta in 1943 and still lives today. Pincher Creek had a humble population of 2,000 people. Like much of rural Alberta, Pincher Creek held particularly conservative political views. She grew up in a time period when the roles of women were changing swiftly. At the beginning of her career, there were not many opportunities for women, and even less so in Pincher Creek. She never planned to study law or politics, but by following the opportunities presented to her, she became a fierce advocate of social, legal, and political equality. Over the course of her life, she's held many titles: daughter, mother, student, lawyer, author, judge, and justice. But most know her as the first woman appointed to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. She served in this position from 2000 to 2017, making her also the longest-serving Chief Justice. By 2018, she was a Companion of the Order of Canada, the highest honor awarded in the order. While many may know her from her achievements in this position, she's less known for her writings. Now, I'll move on to talk about some of her major works and writings. Naturally, many of McLaughlin's works come in the form of justifications for court rulings. As a Chief Justice, she wrote many and frequently spearheaded conversations at the Supreme Court. However, following her retirement from the courts, McLaughlin wrote three books. Two are fiction novels titled Full Disclosure and Denial that are deeply grounded in her legal knowledge. The third is an autobiography titled Truth Be Told. Released in 2019, the book details her political thoughts, life, and positionality that led to her career in the Supreme Court and her fight for women's equality. In Truth Be Told, a major overarching theme of the work is not necessarily of women's empowerment, but of the power of women. That is, the things women inherently are as mothers, sisters, daughters, then maybe lawyers, judges, and justices, and how they are necessary for good, fair, and just politics. While this theme is found throughout her work, it is especially significant to her discussions of the challenges of caregiving and carving out a place for women in political legal leadership. This mentality first appears in what McLaughlin considers to be a major challenge facing women, the burden of caregiving. She first understood this problem as it applied to her mother, who had to sacrifice her potential career to look after her family. This affected her mother's earning abilities and thus her capacity to pursue other interests in a capitalist country. McLaughlin worried about this in her own life when she was considering becoming a judge. She had not wanted to be a lawyer, but a fiction author. She believed that her dream of writing fiction must be sacrificed if she became a mother and a judge, yet she took on the role anyway. Ultimately, she would go on to become a best-selling fiction author anyway, as well as a mother and a Chief Justice. While caregiving is still a burden placed disproportionately on women, McLaughlin's resilience contains the message that it is not necessary for women to sacrifice interests or a career for a family, or a family for a career. Rather, caregiving is expected of them, but women are capable of achieving all that a man can and more when this burden is shared equally across the family. Similarly, by being a pioneering woman in the judiciary, McLaughlin faced difficulties of breaking the glass ceiling and tokenism. Early in her career, there were very few opportunities for women in prestigious career fields. Many women, despite their academic success or achievements, were considered only for secretarial positions in law firms. Breaking through this into the legal field involved patience, persistence, and a bit of luck. When she did, as she was swearing her judicial oath, she realized that she was not chosen for her qualifications, but rather because she was a woman in a changing time that demanded women in the judiciary. While McLachlin originally doubted her abilities because of this, she eventually came to understand the value of her own contributions to political and legal thinking. As I'll explain later, she carves a place for women in powerful positions by appealing to how women's perspectives on issues can lead to more just verdicts by contributing thoughts and addressing issues beyond those of only men's experiences. As such, she posits that women are not only capable of high achievement, but also necessary in positions of power because of their unique contributions. This line of thinking, which emphasizes the power and value of women's thoughts and experiences, led her to becoming one of the greatest forces in Canadian feminism. On that note, I'll take a moment to talk about how she's contributed to the feminist movement in Canada and why her contributions are so important. From a young age, McLachlin was inspired by Queen Elizabeth II. As a justice, she was eventually able to meet her, where McLachlin was awed by her grace and kindness. Interestingly, McLachlin herself can be compared to the earlier Queen Elizabeth I, studied by our class earlier in the year. Both Elizabeth I and McLachlin struggled with breaking glass ceilings and managing the expectations of them, not only as sources of political legal authority, but as women as well. Queen Elizabeth faced these pressures largely through paternalistic power structures, placing the expectation on her to get married. Although she frequently stated her disinterest in marriage, it was not commonly believed that she could rule the Kingdom of England alone because of her gender. There were also concerns of how her royal lineage would be passed down if she did not have an heir. As a result, Elizabeth I ruled by confining her femininity to the common belief in women as weak and appealed to the divine will to reinforce her authority. Using these methods, she was able to retain her political office without a husband or children, despite the beliefs at the time that urged her to have a family. McLachlin's journey is similar. She had to defy and cope with expectations placed upon her because of her gender. How she managed these expectations, however, speaks to modern issues facing women in the current context of the feminist movement. While Elizabeth fought to not have a family, McLachlin worried about how her career affected her ability to have and care for a family. She also worried about her capacities as a judge after she realized she was appointed not despite her gender, but because of it. However, instead of shying away from her femininity as Elizabeth I did, McLachlin embraced the ways her femininity allowed her to see from different perspectives. Whereas Elizabeth aimed to prove women could be capable despite their feminine weakness, McLachlin's many feminist achievements proved how women are equally capable of holding political and legal power because of their femininity. McLachlin's powerful belief in women as fully autonomous and capable beings led to the many great successes for the modern feminist movement. While discussing abortion law, she highlighted the importance of having a diverse bench, as diversity prevents constitutional problems from suffering ignorance or only being partially addressed. This is seen specifically in her ruling and perspectives in Tremblay versus Daigle. Tremblay versus Daigle is the Canadian equivalent of Roe versus Wade and drew the line between fetal rights and a woman's right to bodily security. In this case, Daigle became pregnant and the baby's abusive father attempted to argue for the fetus's legal rights to prevent her from getting an abortion. When it was revealed that the woman had gotten an abortion before the Supreme Court hearing, most of the bench of justices were outraged. McLachlin, however, given her unique understanding of women's issues and the potential danger the ruling posed to women, provided a different view. She argued that while the timing of the abortion was unfortunate for the sake of the case, she can see how this action was not contemptuous, but the result of a scared woman running out of time to save herself from a dangerous situation. This difference in understanding led the court to rule in favor of the woman and secure Canadian women's rights to abortion across the country. This is a ruling that is still in effect and saves the lives of many, many women across the country. Similarly, she's also worked cases involving the rights of LGBT+ people, also Indigenous women, and many, many other marginalized groups. Her voice and presence in these rulings ensured that these cases would not be overtaken by one particular mindset. Instead, McLaughlin's own powerful view of women and of other marginalized groups ensured that this thinking was intertwined with the Canadian legal system. Moving on to the third section of this episode, I'd like to share some of my own thoughts on McLaughlin and everything she's done for the women of Canada. As I stated at the beginning of this episode, McLaughlin, I argue, is one of the most important Canadian political legal thinkers to study. Her feminist mindset is one that is modernly progressive and can be upheld regardless of race, class, or status. Her ultimate message is that women as they are benefit society because they are women. Their perspectives, experiences, and thoughts, different than that of men, allow them to make contributions to political conversation that men cannot. Thus, she highlights not only the general capacities of women to benefit society at large, but the unique importance of the thoughts of every woman because of their different experiences, opinions, and perspectives that have shaped their life. Whereas many political thinkers argue for women's importance despite their status, such as Queen Elizabeth I, McLaughlin actually validates the significance and benefits each and every woman provides to the larger socio-political discussions, both physically and metaphorically, defining a place for them in the political legal system. I'll admit, it is very difficult to critique someone that has brought so much good to the country. If anything, although her message of women's intrinsic power can be widely adopted, McLaughlin may not adequately address the necessity of intersectional feminism. Loosely defined, intersectional feminism acknowledges how things like race, class, and gender can actually intersect to exaggerate inequalities women experience. Perhaps one of the easiest examples of how intersectional feminism works is McLaughlin's own appointment to the Supreme Court of British Columbia. She acknowledges that she was likely chosen because of her gender and the push for women's representation on the benches, as she was only the second woman to be appointed to British Columbia's highest court. However, she was also chosen because she is white and had the capital and resources to achieve multiple degrees. This is to say that if a woman must have been appointed to satisfy the social demand for women's representation, McLaughlin was an indisputable token of a woman's capacities. The political tension around race and class would have made her an unlikely candidate if she was of a different race and ineligible if she was unable to afford a proper education that would allow her to make those judgments. In this example, it's easy to see how race and class may intersect to actually exclude many, many women from the position that McLaughlin was in. However, she does briefly address intersectionality by discussing the unique discrimination and oppression facing Indigenous women. However, intersectional challenges cannot be confined to the binary of white and non-white problems. Rather, different social groups of races and classes have very specific problems that need to be specifically addressed. For instance, Indigenous women and women immigrants face discrimination in different contexts and different manners. Hypothetically, if in Tremblay versus Daigle, Daigle was an immigrant that could not speak English, it is unlikely the Supreme Court would have heard the case. This is because it would be difficult for her to locate and use available resources such as abortion care or retain adequate legal counsel. On the other hand, Indigenous women frequently live in very rural areas of Canada where there are little resources that would be of help to them in an instance like Daigle's. This example highlights both language and geographical barriers that are very different. Because they are different, they need different solutions as well. As a result, without addressing these problems specifically and in their entirety, feminism becomes specifically white-oriented and ends up excluding women of color. Ultimately, all of this is just to say that McLaughlin's message of equality may be better supported if she addressed some of the nuances of intersectional feminism in her future writings. However, with that said, McLaughlin's entry into the Supreme Court and her achievements there trailblaze a path for future women leaders that can address these issues more adequately. In conclusion, There is no doubt that McLaughlin's achievements have been successes for women across Canada. Her decorated tenure as the first woman Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada has paved the route for future generations of women to follow in her footsteps. However, while she is most known for her trailblazing of the judicial system, I believe she's one of the most important political minds of the modern feminist movement in Canada. Her belief in the power of women by virtue of their thoughts and experiences gives every woman, regardless of their identity, a necessary place in the political legal system. In her book, Truth Be Told, she not only tells the story of how she rose to the highest court of Canada, but also gives women today the blueprint for future successes. Although she may not talk about intersectionality to the fullest extent, her achievements in the Supreme Court have indisputably proven that women are capable of being there and belong there. From these stepping stones she's placed, there's now a direct path for other women with more specific needs to have their voices heard in the Supreme Court. It's my hope that McLaughlin's presence in the Supreme Court and her strong voice for equality will inspire other women to follow in her footsteps and secure further rights for women regardless of race or class. As McLaughlin would agree, the best and most just judicial bench is one that is diverse so that there are no perspectives left behind. If you can, I highly suggest picking up a copy of McLaughlin's Truth Be Told so that you can hear her perspectives from her words and reap inspiration from them as well. So, this now marks the end of my discussion of Beverley McLaughlin, the Chief Supreme Court Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada from 2000 to 2017, the first woman and the longest Supreme Court Justice Chief. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed, and I hope you continue to enjoy the rest of the episodes. Goodbye.